I'm okay. What's next? I can do this. I recognized the physical symptoms, which allowed me to reboot my thinking brain and remember the three Ninja Warrior Gremlin moves that are the most effective path to shame resilience for me. And fortunately, I've been practicing these moves long enough to know that they're totally counterintuitive, and I have to trust this process. First, practice courage and reach out. Yes, I want to hide, but the way to fight shame and to honor who we are is by sharing our experience with someone who's earned the right to hear it. Someone who loves us, not despite our vulnerabilities, but because of them. Number two, talk to myself the way I would talk to someone I really love and whom I'm trying to comfort in the midst of a meltdown. You're okay. You're human. We all make mistakes. I've got your back. Normally during a shame attack, we talk to ourselves in ways we would never talk to other people we love and respect. And then three, you got to own the story. Don't bury it and let it fester or define me. I often say this aloud. If you own the story, you get to write the ending. If you own the story, you get to write the ending. When we bury the story, we forever stay the subject of the story. If we own the story, we get to narrate the ending. As Carl Jung said, I'm not what has happened to me. I'm what I choose to become. Even though I knew that the most dangerous thing to do after a shaming experience is to hide or bury our story, I was afraid to make the call, but I did. I called both my husband, Steve, and my good friend, Karen. They gave me what I needed the most, empathy, the best reminder that we're not alone. Rather than judgment, which exacerbates shame, empathy conveys a simple acknowledgement. You're not alone. Empathy is connection. It's a ladder out of the shame hole. Not only did Steve and Karen help me climb out by listening and loving me, but they made themselves vulnerable by sharing that they too had spent some time in that exact same hole. Empathy doesn't require that we have the exact experiences as the person sharing their story with us. Neither Karen nor Steve had sent an email quite like that. But they were both intimately familiar with the imposter gremlins and the getting caught feeling and the oh shit experience. Empathy is connecting with the emotion that someone is experiencing, not the event or the circumstance. Shame dissipated the minute I realized I wasn't alone and that my experience was human. Interestingly, Steve and Karen's responses were totally different. Steve was more serious and more, oh man, I know that feeling. Karen took an approach that had me laughing in about 30 seconds. What the responses shared in common was the power of Me Too. Empathy is a strange and powerful thing. There is no script. There is no right way or wrong way to do it. It's simply listening, holding space, withholding judgment, emotionally connecting, and communicating that incredibly healing message of, you're not alone. My conversations with Steve and Karen allowed me to move through shame, get back on my emotional feet, and respond to the man's I knew it email from a place of authenticity and self-worth. I owned my part in the angry exchange and apologized for my inappropriate language. I also set clear boundaries around future communications. I never heard from him again. Shame thrives on secret keeping, and when it comes to secrets, there's some serious science behind the 12-step program, You're Only as Sick as Your Secrets. In a pioneering study, psychologist and University of Texas professor James Pennebaker and his colleagues studied what happened when trauma survivors, specifically rape and incest survivors, kept their experiences secret. The research team found that the act of not discussing a traumatic event or confiding it to another person could be more damaging than the actual event. Conversely, when people shared their stories and experiences, their physical health improved, their doctor's visits decreased, and they showed significant decreases in their stress hormones. Since his early work on the effects of secret keeping, Pennebaker has focused much of his research on the healing power of expressive writing. In his book, Writing to Heal, Pennebaker writes, since the mid-1980s, an increasing number of studies have focused on the value of expressive writing as a way to bring about healing. The evidence is mounting that the act of writing about traumatic experience for as little as 15 or 20 minutes a day for 3 or 4 days can produce measurable changes in physical and mental health. Emotional writing can also affect people's sleep habits, work efficiency, and how they connect with others. Shame resilience is a practice, and like Pennebaker, I think writing about our shame experiences is an incredibly powerful component of the practice. It takes time to cultivate that practice and courage to reach out and talk about hard things. If you're listening to this and thinking, I'd like to be able to have these conversations with my partner or my friend or my child. Do it. And if you're listening and thinking, shame has become a management style around here, and it's no wonder that folks are disengaged. We should talk about this. Do it. You don't need to figure it out first or master the information before you engage in conversation. You just have to say, I've been listening to a book and there's a chapter about shame. I'd love to talk to you about it. Can we have that conversation? The next section is about men, women, shame, and worthiness. I think you'll want to share this chapter with them as well. What I've learned about men and shame has changed my life. Webs and boxes, how men and women experience shame differently. For the first 4 years of my study on shame, I focused solely on women. At that time, many researchers believed that men and women's experiences of shame are different. I was concerned that if I combined the data from men and women, I'd miss some of the important nuances of their experiences. That I opted just to interview women, I confess, was partially due to my mindset that when it came to worthiness, women were the only ones struggling. At some level, I also think my resistance was based on an intuitive sense that interviewing men would be like stumbling into a new and strange world. As it turns out, it was definitely a strange new world, a world of unspoken hurt. I got a glimpse into that world in 2005 at the end of one of my lectures. A tall, thin man who I'd guess was probably in his early 60s followed his wife to the front of the room. He was wearing a yellow Izod golf sweater, an image I'll never forget. I spoke with his wife for a few minutes as I signed a stack of books that she had bought for herself and her daughters. As she started to walk away, her husband turned to her and said, I'll be right there. Give me a minute. She clearly didn't want him to stay and talk to me. She tried coaxing him with a couple of come-ons, but he didn't budge. I, of course, was thinking, go with her, dude. You're scaring me. After a few unsuccessful attempts, she walked toward the back of the room and he turned to face me at my book signing table. The conversation started innocently enough. I like what you have to say about shame, he told me. It's interesting. I thanked him and waited. I could tell there was more coming. He leaned in closer and asked, I'm curious, what about men and shame? What have you learned about us? I felt instant relief. This wasn't going to take long because I didn't know much. I explained, I haven't done many interviews with men. I just study women. He nodded and said, well, that's convenient. I felt the hair on the back of my neck stand up in defense. I forced a smile and asked, why convenient, in a very high voice that I use when I'm uncomfortable. He replied by asking me if I really wanted to know. I told him yes, which was a half-truth. I was on my guard. Then his eyes welled up with tears. He said, we have shame, deep shame. But when we reach out and share our stories, we get the emotional shit beat out of us. I struggled to maintain eye contact with him. His raw pain had touched me, but I was still trying to protect myself. Just as I was about to make a comment about how hard men are on each other, he said, before you say anything about those mean coaches, bosses, brothers, and fathers being the only ones, he pointed toward the back of the room where his wife was standing and said, my wife and daughters, the ones you signed all those books for, they'd rather see me die on top of my white horse than watch me fall off. You can say that you want us to be vulnerable and real, but come on, you can't stand it. It makes you sick to see us like that. Holding my breath, I had this very visceral reaction to what he was saying. It hit me the way only truth can. He let out a long sigh, and as quickly as he had begun, he said, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks for listening. Then he just walked away. I had spent years researching women and hearing their stories of struggle. In that moment, I realized that men have their own stories, and that if we're going to find our way out of shame, it will be together. So this section is about what I've learned about women, men, how we hurt each other, and how we need each other to heal. What I've come to believe about men and women now that I've studied both is that men and women are equally affected by shame. The messages and expectations that fuel shame are most definitely organized by gender, but the experience of shame is universal and deeply human. Women and the web of shame. When I asked women to share their definitions or experiences of shame, here are some of the comments I heard. Look perfect, do perfect, be perfect. Anything less is shaming. Being judged by other mothers. Being exposed, the flawed parts of yourself that you want to hide from everyone are revealed. Another comma. No matter what I achieve or how far I've come, Where I come from and what I've survived will always keep me from feeling like I'm good enough. Another woman told me, even though everyone knows that there's no way to do it all, everyone still expects it. Shame is when you can't pull off looking like it's under control. Another woman said, shame is never enough at home, never enough at work, never enough in bed, never enough with my parents. Shame is never enough. One young woman in college said, no seat at the cool table. The pretty girls are still laughing. If you recall the 12 shame categories, appearance and body image, money and work, motherhood, fatherhood, family, parenting, mental and physical health, addiction, sex, aging, religion, surviving trauma, and being stereotyped or labeled, the primary trigger for women in terms of its power and universality is the first one, how we look. Still, after all of the consciousness raising and critical awareness, we still feel the most shame about not being thin, young, and beautiful enough. Interestingly, in terms of shame triggers for women, motherhood is a close second. And bonus, you don't have to be a mother to experience mother shame. Society views womanhood and motherhood as inextricably bound. Therefore, our value as women is often determined by where we are in relation to our roles as mothers or potential mothers. Women are constantly asked why they haven't married, or if they've married, why they haven't had children. Even women who are married and have one child are asked why they don't have a second child. You've had your kids too far apart. What were you thinking? Too close. Why? That's so unfair to the kids. If you're working outside the home, the first question is, what about the children? If you're not working, the first question is, what kind of example are you setting for your daughters? Mother shame is ubiquitous. It's a birthright for girls and women. But the real struggle for women, what amplifies shame regardless of the category, is that we are expected by others, and sometimes desire ourselves, to be perfect, yet we're not allowed to look as if we're working for it. We want it to just materialize somehow. Everything should be effortless. The expectation is to be natural beauties, natural mothers, natural leaders, and naturally good parents. And we want to belong to naturally fabulous families. Think about how much money has been made selling products that promise the natural look. And when it comes to work, we love to hear, she makes it look so easy, or she's a natural. As I found myself reading through the pages of definitions and examples provided by women, I kept envisioning a web. What I saw was a sticky, complex spider web of layered, conflicting, and competing expectations that dictate exactly who we should be, what we should be, and how we should be. When I think of my own efforts to be everything to everyone, something that women are socialized to do, I can see how every move I make just ensnares me even more in this web. Every effort to twist my way out of the web just leads to becoming more stuck. That's because every choice has a consequence or leads to someone being disappointed. The web is a metaphor for the classic double bind situation. Writer Marilyn Frye describes a double bind as a situation in which options are very limited and all of them expose us to penalty, censure, or deprivation. If you take the competing and conflicting expectations, which are often unattainable from the get-go, you have this. Be perfect, but don't make a fuss about it, and don't take away time from anything, like your family or your partner or your work, to achieve your perfection. If you're really good, perfection should be easy. Don't upset anyone or hurt anyone's feelings, but say what's on your mind. Dial the sexuality way up. After the kids are down, the dog has walked, and the house is clean. But dial it way down at the PTO meeting, and geez, whatever you do, don't confuse the two. You know how we talk about those PTO sex pots. Just be yourself, but not if it means being shy or unsure. There's nothing sexier than self-confidence, especially if you're young and smoking hot. Don't make people feel uncomfortable, but be honest. Don't get too emotional, but don't be too detached either. Too emotional and you're hysterical. Too detached and you're a cold-hearted bitch. In a U.S. study on conformity to feminine norms, researchers recently listed the most important attributes associated with being feminine as nice, pursuing a thin body ideal, showing modesty by not calling attention to one's talents or abilities, being domestic, caring for children, investing in a romantic relationship, keeping sexual intimacy contained with one committed relationship, and using our resources to invest in our appearance. Basically, we have to be willing to stay as small, sweet, and quiet as possible and use our time and talent to look pretty. Our dreams, ambitions, and gifts are unimportant. God forbid that some girl who has the cure for cancer, tucked away in her abilities, finds this list and decides to follow the rules. If she does, we'll never know her genius. And I feel sure of that. Why? Because every successful woman whom I've interviewed has talked to me about the sometimes daily struggle to push past the rules so she can assert herself, advocate for her ideas, and feel comfortable with her power and gifts. Even to me, the issue of stay small, sweet, quiet, and modest sounds like an outdated problem. But the truth is that women still run into those demands whenever we find and use our voices. When the TEDx Houston video went viral, I wanted to hide. I begged my husband Steve to hack into the TED website and bring down the entire thing. I fantasized about breaking into the offices where they were keeping the video and stealing it. I was desperate. That was when I realized that I had unconsciously worked throughout my career to keep my work small. I loved writing for my community of readers because preaching to the choir is easy and relatively safe. The quick and global spread of my work was exactly what I'd always tried to avoid. I didn't want the exposure, and I was terrified of the mean-spirited criticism that's so rampant in internet culture. Well, let me tell you, the mean-spiritedness, it happened. And the vast majority of it was directed to reinforcing those norms that we would love to believe are outdated. When a news outlet shared the video on their site, a heated debate erupted in the comments section of their website about, of course, my weight. How can she talk about worthiness when she needs to lose 15 pounds? On another site, a debate grew about the appropriateness of mothers having breakdowns. I feel sorry for her children. Good mothers don't fall apart. Another commenter wrote, less research, more Botox. Something similar happened when I wrote an article on imperfection for CNN.com. To accompany the article, the editor used a photo I had taken of a good friend who had I am enough written across the top of her chest. It's a beautiful photo that I have hanging in my study as a reminder. Well, that fueled comments like, she may believe that she's enough, but by the look of that chest, she could use some more. And if I looked like Brené Brown, I'd embrace imperfection too. I know that these examples are symptomatic of the cruelty culture that we live in today, and that everyone is fair game. But I want you to think about how and what they chose to attack. They went after my appearance and my mothering. Two kill shots taken straight from the list of feminine norms. They didn't go after my intellect or my arguments. That wouldn't hurt enough. So no, those societal norms are not outdated, even if they're reductionistic and squeeze the life out of us, and shame is the route to enforcing them. Which is another reminder of why shame resilience is a prerequisite for vulnerability. I believe I dared greatly in my TEDx Houston talk. Talking about my struggles was a courageous thing for me to do, given my drive to self-protect and use research as armor. And the only reason I'm still standing is because I've cultivated some pretty fierce shame resilience skills, and I'm crystal clear that courage is an important value to me. I clearly saw that these comments triggered shame in me, and I could quickly reality check the messages. Yeah, they still hurt. Yes, I was pissed. Yes, I cried my eyes out. Yes, I wanted to disappear. But I gave myself permission to feel these things for a couple of hours or days. Then I reached out, talked through my feelings with people I trust and love, and moved on. I felt more courageous, more compassionate, and more connected. I also stopped reading anonymous comments. Look, if you're not in the arena with the rest of us fighting and getting your ass kicked on occasion, I'm not interested in your feedback. How men experience shame. When I asked men to define shame or give me an example, here's what I heard. Shame is failure. At work, on the football field, in your marriage, in bed, with money, with your children, it doesn't matter. Shame is failure. Another man said, shame is being wrong. Not doing it wrong, but being wrong. Another guy said, shame is a sense of being defective. Another comment, shame happens when people think you're soft. It's degrading and shaming to be seen as anything but tough. Revealing any weakness is shaming. Basically, shame is weakness. Another man said, showing fear is shameful. You can't show fear. You can't be afraid no matter what. I'll never forget this interview with a man who was probably in his 70s. He said, shame is being seen as the guy you can shove up against the lockers. In this last example, Our worst fear is being criticized or ridiculed. Either one of these is extremely shaming. Basically, men live under the pressure of one unrelenting message. Do not be perceived as weak. Whenever my graduate students were doing the interviews with men, I told them to prepare for three things: high school stories, sports metaphors, and the word pussy. If you're thinking that you can't believe I just wrote that, I get it. It's one of my least favorite words. But as a researcher, I know it's important to be honest about what emerged. And that word came up all of the time in the interviews. It didn't matter if the man was 18 or 80. If I asked, what's the shame message? The answer was, don't be a pussy. When I first started writing about my work with men, I used the image of a box, something that looked like a shipping crate, to explain how shame traps men. Like the demands on women to be naturally beautiful, thin, and perfect at everything, especially motherhood, the box has rules that tell men what they should and shouldn't do, and who they're allowed to be. But for men, every rule comes back to the same mandate. Don't be weak. I'll never forget when a 20-year-old man who was part of a small group of college students that I was interviewing said, "Let me show you the box." I knew he was a tall guy, but when he stood up, it was clear that he was at least 6'4". He said, "Imagine living like this," as he crouched down and pretended that he was stuffed inside of a small box. Still hunched over, he said, "You really only have three choices. You spend your life fighting to get out, throwing punches at the side of the box and hoping it will break. You always feel angry and you're always swinging. Or you just give up. You don't give a shit about anything." At that point, he slumped over on the ground. You could have heard a pin drop in this room. Then he stood up and shook his head and said, "Or you stay so high, you don't really notice how unbearable it is. That's the easiest way." The students grabbed on to stay high like a life preserver and broke into nervous laughter. That happens a lot when you're talking about shame or vulnerability, anything to cut the tension. But this brave young man wasn't laughing, and neither was I. His demonstration was one of the most honest and courageous things I've ever had the privilege of seeing, and I know that the people in that room were deeply affected by it. After the group interview, he told me about his experiences growing up. He had been a passionate artist as a child, and he winced as he described how he was sure from an early age that he'd be happy if he could spend his life painting and drawing. He said that one day he was in the kitchen with his dad and his uncle. His uncle pointed to a collection of his art that was plastered on the refrigerator and jokingly said to his father, "What are you, raising a faggot artist now?" After that, he said, his father, who had always been neutral about his art, forbade him from taking classes. Even his mother, who had always been so proud of his talent, agreed that it was a little too girly. He told me that he had drawn a picture of his house the day before all this had happened, and to that day it was the last thing he had ever drawn. That night I wept for him and for all of us who would never get to see his work. I think about him all the time and hope he is reconnected with his art. I know it's a tremendous loss for him, and I'm equally positive that the world is missing out. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. As I've learned more about men and their experiences with shame, I still see that image of a shipping crate with a big stamp across it that reads, "Caution, do not be perceived as weak." I see how boys are issued a crate when they're born. It's not too crowded when they're toddlers. They're still small and they can move around a bit. They can cry or hold on to mama, but as they grow older, there's less and less wiggle room. And by the time they're grown men, it's suffocating. But just as with women, men are caught in their own double bind. Over the last couple of years, especially since the economic downturn, what I've started to see is this box from The Wizard of Oz. I'm talking about the small, curtain-concealed box that the wizard stands in as he's controlling the mechanical, great, and powerful Oz image. As scarcity has grabbed hold of our culture, it's not just don't be perceived as weak, but also, you better be great and all-powerful. This image first came to mind when I interviewed a man who was in deep shame about getting downsized. He told me, "It's funny. My father knows. My two closest friends know. But my wife doesn't know. It's been 6 months and every morning I still get dressed and leave the house like I'm going to work. I drive across town, sit in coffee shops, and look for a job." I'm a skilled interviewer, but I can imagine that the look on my face conveyed something like, "How on earth do you pull that off?" Without waiting for my next question, he answered, "She doesn't want to know. If she already knows, she wants me to keep pretending. Trust me, if I find another job and tell her after I'm back at work, she'll be grateful. Knowing would change the way she feels about me. She didn't sign up for this." I was not prepared to hear over and over from men how the women, the mothers, sisters, girlfriends, wives, in their lives are constantly criticizing them for not being open and vulnerable and intimate. All the while, they are standing in front of that cramped wizard closet where their men are huddled inside, adjusting the curtain and making sure no one sees in and no one gets out. There was a moment when I was driving home from an interview with a small group of men and thought, holy shit, I am the patriarchy. Here's the painful pattern that emerged from my research with men. We ask them to be vulnerable. We beg them to let us in. And we plead with them to tell us when they're afraid. But the truth is most women can't stomach it. In those moments when real vulnerability happens in men, most of us recoil with fear, and that fear manifests as everything from disappointment to disgust. And men are very smart. They know the risks, and they see the look in our eyes when we're thinking, come on, pull it together, man up. As Joe Reynolds, one of my mentors and the dean at our church, once told me during a conversation about men's shame and vulnerability, men know what women really want. They want us to pretend to be vulnerable. We get very good at pretending. Covert shame hurts just as much as overt shame. Take, for example, the man who told me that he was always feeling shame with his wife around money. He said the latest instance was when his wife came home and said, "Oh, I just saw Katie's new house. It's amazing. She's so happy to finally get that dream house. And on top of that, she's going to quit working next year." He told me his immediate response was rage. So he picked a fight with his wife about her mother coming to visit and then quickly disappeared to another part of the house. As we were talking about this conversation, he said, "It was shame. Why did she have to say that? I get it. Katie's husband makes a lot of money. He takes better care of her. I can't compete." When I asked him if he thought that it was her intention to hurt him or shame him, he responded, "I'm not sure. Who knows? I turned down a job that paid a lot more but required traveling 3 weeks out of the month. She said she was supportive and that she and the kids would miss me too much. But now she makes little comments about money all the time. I really have no idea what to think." Pissed off or shut down. I don't want to oversimplify something as complex as the response to shame, but I have to say that when it comes to men, there seem to be two primary responses, pissed off or shut down. Of course, like women, as men develop shame resilience, this changes, and men learn to respond to shame with awareness, self-compassion, and empathy. But without that awareness, when men feel that rush of inadequacy and smallness, they normally respond with anger and or by completely turning off. Once I had collected enough interviews to start seeing strong patterns and themes, I scheduled interviews with several male therapists who specialize in men's issues. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't filtering what I heard from the men through my own experiences. When I asked one of these therapists about the concept of pissed off or shut down, he told me this story to illustrate the point. When he was a freshman in high school, he tried out and made the football team. On the first day of practice, his coach told the boys to line up on the line of scrimmage. The therapist had grown up playing a lot of football in his neighborhood, but this was his first experience on a field, in full pads, across from boys whose goal was to flatten him. He said, "I was suddenly afraid. I was thinking about how much it was going to hurt, and I guess that fear showed up on my face." He said his coach yelled his last name and said, "Don't be a pussy, get on the line." He said he immediately felt shame coursing through his body. He told me, "In that single moment, I became very clear about how the world works and what it means to be a man. I'm not allowed to be afraid. I'm not allowed to show fear. I'm not allowed to be vulnerable. Shame is being afraid, showing fear, or being vulnerable." When I asked him what he did next, he looked me in the eye and said, "I turned my fear into rage and steamrolled over the guy in front of me. It worked so well that I spent the next 20 years turning my fear and vulnerability into rage and steamrolling anyone who was across from me. My wife, my children, my employees. There was no other way out from underneath the fear and shame." I heard such grief and clarity in his voice as he was saying this to me. It made total sense. Fear and vulnerability are powerful emotions. You can't just wish them away. You have to do something with them. Many men, in fact, use very physiological descriptions when they talk to me about pissed off or shut down. It's almost as if shame, criticism, and ridicule are physically intolerable. The therapist concluded, I got into therapy when my rage and my drinking were no longer manageable, when it started costing me my marriage and my relationships with my children. That's why I do the work I do today. Shame resilience, the four elements we discussed in the previous chapter, is about finding a middle path, an option that allows us to stay engaged and to find the emotional courage we need to respond in a way that aligns with our values. I'm only as hard on others as I am on myself. Just like the father coming down on his budding artist son or the coach giving his player a hard time, women can also be very hard on other women. We are hard on others because we're hard on ourselves. That's exactly how judgment works. Finding someone to put down, judge, or criticize becomes a way to get out of the web or call attention away from our box. If you're doing worse than I am at something, I think to myself, well, my chances of surviving are better. Steve and I met lifeguarding and coaching swimming. The big rule in lifeguarding is to utilize any means possible before you actually jump in and try to pull someone out of the water. Even though you're a strong swimmer and the person you're trying to help is half your size, a desperate person will do anything to save themselves, to grab a breath, including drowning you in their effort to survive. The same is true for women in the shame web. We're so desperate to get out and stay out of shame that we're constantly serving up the people around us as more deserving prey. What's ironic, or perhaps natural, is that the research tells us that we judge people in areas where we're vulnerable to shame, especially picking folks who are doing worse than we're doing. If I feel good about my parenting, I have no interest in judging other people's choices. If I feel good about my body, I don't go around making fun of other people's weight or appearance. We're hard on each other because we're using each other as a launching pad out of our own shame. It's hurtful and ineffective. And if you look at the mean girl culture in middle schools and high schools, it's also contagious. We've handed this counterfeit survival mechanism down to our children. In my interviews with teachers and school administrators, two patterns emerge that speak directly to this issue. The first pattern reported by faculty and principals was that often the children who are engaging in the bullying behaviors or vying for social ranking by putting down others have parents who engage in the same behaviors. When it came to the girls, the phrase that kept emerging from the interviews was, "The parents aren't upset by their daughter's behaviors. They're proud of them for being popular." One school administrator likened this behavior to the fathers who first asked, "Well, did he at least win the fight?" The other pattern, which has only emerged in the last couple of years, is the age of the children when this starts happening. When I started this work, bullying wasn't a hot topic, but as a shame researcher, I was aware that it was a growing trend. In fact, I wrote an op-ed on bullying and reality television for the Houston Chronicle over 16 years ago. Back then, my focus was teenagers because the data pointed to adolescence as the prime age range for these behaviors. In the past couple of years, I'm hearing about girls and boys as young as first grade engaging in these behaviors. How do we break this insidious pattern? Maybe by deciding and showing our children that the solution to being stuck in shame is not to denigrate others stuck just like us, but to join hands and pull free together. For example, if we're at the grocery store and we push our cart past another mother whose child is screaming bloody murder and throwing Cheerios on the floor, we have a choice. If we choose to use that moment to confirm that we're better than she is and that she's stuck in the web in ways that we are not, we will roll our eyes in disapproval and walk by. Our other choice, though, is to flash that mother our best, "You're not alone, sister, I've been there," smile, because we know what she's feeling. Yes, empathy requires some vulnerability, and we risk getting back a mind your own damn business look, but it's worth it. That response doesn't just loosen up the web for her. It loosens it up for us the next time it's our child and our Cheerios. And you can bet it will be. What gives me hope about our willingness to extend a hand back and support each other is the increasing number of men and women I encounter who are willing to risk vulnerability and share their stories of shame resilience. I see this in formal and informal mentoring programs. I see this from folks who are writing blogs and sharing their experiences with readers. I see it in schools and programs that are not only becoming less tolerant of student bullying, but are holding teachers, administrators, and parents accountable for those behaviors. Adults are being asked to model the wholeheartedness that they want to see in children. There is a quiet transformation happening that is moving us from turning on each other to turning toward each other. Without question, that transformation will require shame resilience. If we're willing to dare greatly and risk vulnerability with each other, worthiness has the power to set us free. It's not about the back fat. Men, women, sex, and body image. In 2006, I met with 22 community college students, male and female, to talk about shame. It was my first co-ed large group interview. At some point, a young man in his early 20s explained how he'd recently divorced his wife after coming back from serving in the military and finding out that she was having an affair. He said he wasn't surprised because he never felt good enough for her. He explained that he constantly asked her what she needed and wanted, and that every time he got close to meeting her needs, she moved the goalposts another 10 feet. A young woman in the class spoke up and said, "Guys are the same way. They're never satisfied either. We're never pretty, sexy, or skinny enough." Within seconds, a conversation broke out about body image and sex. The discussion was mostly about how it's so scary to have sex with someone you care about when you're worried about how your body looks. The young woman who started the conversation said, "It's not easy to have sex and keep your stomach sucked in. How can we get into it when we're worried about our back fat?" The young man who shared his story of his divorce slammed his hand down on the desk and shouted, "It's not about the back fat. You're worried about it. We are not. We don't give a shit." The class fell completely quiet. He took a couple of deep breaths and said, "Stop making up all of this stuff about what we're thinking. What we're really thinking is, do you love me? Do you care about me? Do you want me? Am I important to you? Am I good enough? That's what we're thinking. When it comes to sex, it feels like our life is on the line, and you're worried about that crap?" At that point, half of the young men in the room were so emotional that they had their faces in their hands. A few girls were in tears, and I couldn't breathe. The young woman who had brought up the body image issue said, I don't understand. My last boyfriend was always criticizing my body." The young vet, who had just brought us all to our knees, replied, "That's because he's an asshole. It's not because he's a guy. Some of us are just guys. Give us a break, please." A middle-aged man in the group joined in, staring straight down at his desk. He said, "It's true. When you want to be with us in that way, it makes us feel more worthy. We stand a little taller, believe in ourselves more. I don't know why, but it's true. And I've been married since I was 18. It still feels that way with my wife." Never in my life before that moment did I think about men feeling vulnerable about sex. Never did I consider that their self-worth was in any way on the line. I didn't understand. So I interviewed many more men about the topic of sexuality, shame, and worthiness, including mental health professionals. In one of my final interviews on the topic, I sat down with a therapist who had spent more than 25 years working with men. He explained that from the time boys are 8 to 10 years old, they learn that initiating sex is their responsibility and that sexual rejection soon becomes the hallmark of masculine shame. He explained, "Even in my own life, when my wife isn't interested, I still have to battle feelings of shame. It doesn't matter if I intellectually understand why she's not in the mood. I'm vulnerable and it's very difficult." When I asked him about his work around addiction and pornography, he gave me an answer that helped me understand that issue in an entirely new light. He said, "For $5 in 5 minutes, you think you're getting what you need and you don't have to risk rejection." The reason that response was so revelatory for me was because it was so utterly different from what women felt. After interviewing women for a decade, it was clear that women see the issue of men and pornography as having to do with their own inadequate appearance and or their lack of sexual experience. At the end of my interview with this wonderful and wise man, he said, "I guess the secret is that sex is terrifying for most men. That's why you see everything from porn to the violent, desperate attempts to exercise power and control. Rejection is deeply painful." Cultivating intimacy, physical or emotional, is almost impossible when our shame triggers meet head-on and create the perfect shame storm. Sometimes these shame storms are directly about sex and intimacy, but often there are outlying gremlins wreaking havoc in our relationships. Common issues include body image, aging, appearance, money, parenting, motherhood, exhaustion, resentment, fear. When I asked men and women and couples how they practiced wholeheartedness around these very sensitive and personal issues, one answer came up again and again. Honest, loving conversations that require major vulnerability. We have to be able to talk about how we feel, what we need and desire, and we have to be able to listen with an open heart and an open mind. There is no intimacy without vulnerability. Yet another powerful example of vulnerability as courage. The words we can never take back. I open this section with a quote from Top Gun. Too close for missiles, I'm switching to guns. When I talk to couples, I can see how shame creates one of the dynamics most lethal to a relationship. Women who feel shame when they don't feel heard or validated often resort to pushing and provoking with criticism. Why don't you ever do enough? Why don't you ever get it right? Men, in turn, who feel shame when they feel criticized for being inadequate, either shut down, leading women to poke and provoke more, or come back with anger. For the first few years of our marriage, Steve and I fell into this pattern. I remember one argument when we were both angry beyond belief. After 10 minutes of endless chiding on my part, he turned to me and said, "Leave me alone for 20 minutes. I'm done. I won't do this anymore." When he shut and locked the door, I got so mad that I actually banged on the door and said, "Get back out here and fight with me." In that moment when I heard myself, I saw what was happening. He was on the verge of shutting down or raging, and I was feeling unheard and misunderstood. The result was mutual desperation. Steve and I have been married for 24 years, together for 31. He is, without question, the best thing that's ever happened to me. When we got married, neither one of us had any idea what a good partnership looked like or what it took to make it work. If you asked us today what we believe is the key to our relationship, the answer is vulnerability. We just keep showing up even though we have no idea what in the hell we're doing. We've learned some of our lessons through good old trial and error, but we also learned from my work and the research participants who were brave enough to share their stories with me. I'm so grateful to them. I think we can all agree that feeling shame is an incredibly painful experience. What we often don't realize is that perpetrating shame is equally as painful, and no one does that with the precision of a partner or a parent. These are the people who know us best and who bear witness to our vulnerability and fears. Thankfully, we can apologize for shaming someone we love. But the truth is that those shaming comments leave marks. And shaming someone we love around vulnerability is the most serious of all security breaches. Even if we apologize, we've done some serious damage because we've demonstrated our willingness to use sacred information as a weapon. In The Gifts of Imperfection, I share the definition of love that I developed based on the data. Here it is. We cultivate love when we allow our most vulnerable and powerful selves to be deeply seen and known, when we honor the spiritual connection that grows from this offering with trust, respect, kindness, and affection. Love is not something we give or get. It's something that we nurture and grow, a connection that can only be cultivated between two people when it exists within each one of them. We can only love others as much as we love ourselves. Shame, blame, disrespect, betrayal, and the withholding of affection damage the roots from which love grows. Love can only survive these injuries if they are acknowledged, healed, and rare. Developing this definition was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Professionally, it just seemed arrogant to try to define something as big and as important as love. It felt like an endeavor best left to the poets and the artists. My motivation was not to nail it, but to start a conversation about what we need and want from love. I don't care if I'm wrong, but let's talk about love. Let's have some conversations about the experience that gives meaning to our lives. Personally, I fought the data with everything I have. Over and over, I heard the idea of self-love as a prerequisite to loving others, and I hated it. Sometimes it's so much easier to love Steve and the kids than it is to love myself. It's so much easier to accept their quirks and eccentricities than it is to practice self-love around what I see as my deep flaws. But in practicing self-love over the past couple of years, I can say that it has immeasurably deepened my relationship with the people I love. It's given me the courage to show up and be vulnerable in new ways. And that's what love is all about. As we think about shame and love, the most pressing question is this. Are we practicing love? Yes. Most of us are really good at professing it, sometimes 10 times a day. But are we walking the talk? Are we being our most vulnerable selves? Are we showing trust and kindness, affection, and respect to our partners? It's not the lack of professing that gets us in trouble in our relationships. It's failing to practice love that leads to hurt. Becoming real. Do you remember how I mentioned earlier in the chapter that researchers found that attributes such as nice, thin, and modest were qualities that our culture associates with femininity? Well, when looking at the attributes associated with masculinity in the U.S., the same researchers identified the following: winning, emotional control, risk-taking, violence, dominance, playboy, self-reliance, primacy of work, power over women, disdain for homosexuality, and pursuit of status. Understanding these lists and what they mean is critically important to understanding shame and cultivating resilience. As I explained in the beginning of the chapter, shame is universal, but the messages and expectations that drive shame are organized by gender. These feminine and masculine norms are the foundation of shame triggers, and here's why. If women want to play by the rules, they need to be sweet, thin, and pretty, stay quiet, be perfect moms and wives, and not own their power. One move outside these expectations and bam, the shame web closes in. Men, on the other hand, need to stop feeling, start earning, put everyone in their place, and climb their way to the top or die trying. Push open the lid of your box to grab a breath of air or slide that curtain back a bit to see what's going on, and bam, shame cuts you down to size. I think it's important to add that for men, there's also a cultural message that promotes homophobic cruelty. If you want to be masculine in our culture, it's not enough to be straight. You must also show an outward disgust toward the gay community. The idea of do this or dislike these people if you want to be accepted into our group emerged as a major shame setup in the research. It doesn't matter if the group is a church or a gang or a sewing circle or masculinity itself. Asking members to dislike, disown, or distance themselves from another group of people as a condition of belonging is always about control and power. I think we have to question the intentions of any group that insists on disdain toward other people as a membership requirement. It may be disguised as belonging, but real belonging doesn't necessitate disdain. When I look at those 11 attributes of masculinity, that's not the kind of man I want to spend my life with. And that's not how I want to raise my son. The word that comes to mind when I think about a life built around those qualities is lonely. The picture in my mind goes back to the Wizard of Oz. He's not a real person with human needs, but a great and powerful projection of what a man is supposed to be. Lonely, exhausting, and soul-sucking. When I talk to men and women with high levels of shame resilience, they are keenly aware of these lists. They keep those strictures in mind so that when shame starts creeping up on them, or they find themselves fully in shame, they can reality check these norms, thus practicing the second element of shame resilience, critical awareness. Basically, they can choose consciously not to play along. The man in shame says, "I'm not supposed to get emotional when I have to lay off these people." The man practicing shame resilience responds, "I'm not buying into this message. I've worked with these guys for 5 years. I know their families. I'm allowed to care about them." Shame whispers in the ear of the woman who's out of town on business, "You're not a good mom because you're going to miss your son's class play." She replies, "I hear you, but I'm not playing that tape today. My mothering is way bigger than one class performance. You can leave now." One of the most powerful ways that our shame triggers get reinforced is when we enter into a social contract based on these gender straitjackets. Our relationships are defined by women and men saying, "I'll play my role and you play yours." One of the patterns revealed in the research was all about how that role playing becomes almost unbearable around midlife. Men feel increasingly disconnected and the fear of failure becomes paralyzing. Women are exhausted, and for the first time, they begin to clearly see the expectations are impossible. The accomplishments, accolades, and acquisitions that are a seductive part of living by this contract start to feel like a Faustian bargain. Remembering that shame is the fear of disconnection, the fear that we're unlovable and don't belong, makes it easy to see why so many people in midlife overfocus on their children's lives, work 60 hours a week, or turn to affairs, addiction, and disengagement. We start to unravel. The expectations and messages that fuel shame keep us from fully realizing who we are as people. Today, I look back and feel so grateful to the people who have shared their stories with me. I'm thankful for the people who were brave enough to say, "These are my secrets and my fears. Here's how they brought me to my knees, and here's how I learned to stand again in my worthiness." I'm also indebted to the man in the yellow Izod sweater. His vulnerability and honesty set in motion work that has forever changed my career and, more importantly, my life. As I look back on what I've learned about shame, gender, and worthiness, the greatest lesson is this. If we're going to find our way out of shame and back to each other, vulnerability is the path and courage is the light. To set down those lists of what we're supposed to be is brave. To love ourselves and support each other in the process of becoming real is perhaps the greatest single act of daring greatly. I'll leave you with this passage from the 1922 children's classic, The Velveteen Rabbit, by Marjorie Williams. My friend Dee Dee Parker Wright sent it to me last year with a note that said, "This is what being wholehearted is all about." I agree. It's a beautiful reminder of how much easier it is to become real when we know we're loved. From The Velveteen Rabbit. "Real isn't how you're made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you when a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you. Then you become real." "Does it hurt?" asked the rabbit. "Sometimes," said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. "When you are real, you don't mind being hurt." "Does it happen all at once, like being wound up?" he asked, "or bit by bit?" "It doesn't happen all at once," said the skin horse. "You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily, or have sharp edges, or have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off, and your eyes drop out, and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly. Except to people who don't understand." Chapter 4. The Vulnerability Armory. As children, we found ways to protect ourselves from vulnerability, from being hurt, diminished, and disappointed. We put on armor, we used our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors as weapons, and we learned how to make ourselves scarce, even to disappear. Now, as adults, we realize that to live with courage, purpose, and connection, to be the person whom we long to be, we must again be vulnerable. We must take off the armor, put down the weapons, show up, and let ourselves be seen. The word persona is the Greek term for stage mask. In my work, masks and armor are perfect metaphors for how we protect ourselves from the discomfort of vulnerability. Masks make us feel safer even when they become suffocating. Armor makes us feel stronger, even when we grow weary from dragging the extra weight around. The irony is that when we're standing across from someone who is hidden or shielded by masks and armor, we feel frustrated and disconnected. That's the paradox here. Vulnerability is the last thing I want you to see in me, but the very first thing I look for in you. If I were directing a play about vulnerability armory, the setting would be a middle school cafeteria, and the characters would be our 11, 12, and 13-year-old selves. I pick this age because armor can be hard to see on adults. Once we've worn it long enough, it molds to our shape and is ultimately undetectable. It's like a second skin. Masks are the same way. I've interviewed hundreds of participants who conveyed the same fear. "I can't take the mask off now. No one even knows what I really look like. Not my partner, not my kids, not my friends. They've never met the real me. I'm not even sure who I am under here." Preteens or tweens, though, are much different. Upper elementary school and middle school is where most of us started to try on new and different forms of protection. At this tender age, the armor is still awkward and ill-fitting. Kids are clumsy in their efforts to hide fear and self-doubt, which makes it easier for observers to see exactly what armor they're using and why. And depending on the level of shame and fear, most kids have yet to be convinced that the heaviness of the armor or the suffocating nature of a mask is worth the effort. They put on and take off personas and protection without hesitation, sometimes in the same sentence. I don't care what those people think. They're so stupid. The dance is stupid. Can you call their moms and find out what they're wearing? I mean, I hope I get to dance. The after-school specials of my youth seemed to be dedicated to exploring just these ideas. They brought us the mean boy who really just wanted to be included and the know-it-all girl who was showing off at school to hide her misery over her parents' recent divorce. Our protection mechanisms may be more sophisticated now that we're adults, but most of us learned about armor during these raw and impressionable years, and most of us can be brought back to that place in a heartbeat. From my personal experiences, I can tell you that the most difficult thing about parenting a daughter in middle school is coming face to face with the awkward, sweaty palm seventh grader who lives inside me. My instinct back then was to duck and run, and I often feel that impulse creeping up on me when Ellen is in struggle. I swear there are times when she's describing a situation at school that I can actually smell my middle school cafeteria. Whether we're 14 or 54, our armor and our masks are as individualized and unique as the personal vulnerability, discomfort, and pain we're trying to minimize. That's why I was surprised to discover that we all share a small array of common protection mechanisms. Our armor may be custom-made, but certain parts of it are interchangeable. By prying open the doors of the armory, we can expose to daylight the more universal bits and pieces, and also rummage through the closets that house less universal but often dangerous items of vulnerability protection. If you're like me, it's tempting to take this information and create your own after-school special. As these shared mechanisms started to emerge from the data, my first instinct was to label behavior and cast the people around me as stereotypes. She so wears this mask, and my neighbor totally uses this armor. It's human nature to want to categorize and oversimplify, but I think that misses the point. None of us uses just one of these shared defenses. Most of us will be able to relate to almost all of them, depending on the different circumstances we navigate. My hope is that a peek inside the armory will help us to look inside ourselves. How do we protect ourselves? When and how did we start using these defense mechanisms? What would it take to make us put the armor away? The enough mandate. For me, the most powerful part of this research was discovering the strategies that seem to empower people to take off the masks and armor that I'm about to describe. I assumed that I'd find unique strategies for each protection mechanism, similar to what emerged in the 10 guideposts I write about in The Gifts of Imperfection. But that wasn't the case here. In the first chapter, I talked about enough as the opposite of scarcity, and the properties of scarcity as shame, comparison, and disengagement. Well, it appears that believing that we're enough is actually the way out of the armor. It gives us permission to take off the mask. With that sense of enough comes an embrace of worthiness, boundaries, and engagement. This lay at the core of every strategy illuminated by the research participants for freeing themselves from their armor. I am enough, which is worthiness versus shame. I've had enough, boundaries versus one-upping in comparison. Showing up, taking risks, and letting myself be seen is enough. Engagement versus disengagement. As you listen to this chapter, I think it's helpful for you to know that every single person I've interviewed spoke about struggling with vulnerability. It's not like there are lucky people among us who can openly embrace vulnerability without reservation or hesitation or fear. When it comes to uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure, what I heard over and over were descriptions of people trying on some kind of armor, then finally letting it go. For example, my first instinct is to blank. But that never works, so now I try to do this, and that's changed my life. Or I spent years doing this until one day I tried this new, more vulnerable thing, and it made my marriage stronger. Last year, I gave a talk on vulnerability to 350 SWAT team officers, parole officers, and jailers. Yes, it was as intimidating as it sounds. A SWAT officer walked up to me after the talk and said,